2020, and this is the 15th class in the continuing series. In response to some comments on the YouTube, I'm actually going to be adding descriptions of what was discussed. Otherwise, it could be hard if you want to go back and find what you're looking for. As always, take a few minutes and respond to comments and questions. First, let me share my screen here. To Chaim Meiselman from Philadelphia. We spoke about this word, Aleph Reish Shin, last week, and he wanted to know, could it be read as eres, as in poison, like a negative thing? Because Yaakov Emden criticizes other people in this book. No, I don't think so, because although sin and samech are often used interchangeably, it wouldn't be used here. It would be a samech, and it's a strange thing to call your work eres, as in poison. But I encourage everyone who's interested in Jewish books to go on YouTube and listen to Chaim Meiselman's classes on old Jewish books. First thing. Second thing is Norm Eisen. We spoke about him in the end of last class. Here you can see him. If you can always move the pictures on the side if you can't see everything. Norm Eisen, he was the person, the ambassador, observant Jew who was ambassador to Prague. I didn't even realize, I just saw this when I went to Wikipedia after the class, that he was a counsel for the Democrats during the Trump impeachment. So that is of interest. We had a lot of discussion last class about the tshuva, the response of Ephraim Greenblatt, where he permitted a convert under 3 years old, a girl who was converted under three, and who was adopted as a child, to marry a Kohen. And I said that this is quite unusual. All the Rishonim say this is forbidden. There is an opinion in the Gemara, but none of the Rishonim say this is permissible. And I'm wondering if anyone knows of any examples. I misspoke a bit. I described it as rejected by the Talmud. David Eisen pointed out it's never rejected by the Talmud. However, it is rejected by all the Rishonim. And I wondered, do we have any other examples where an opinion that unanimously is rejected by the Rishonim, in an emergency, you can adopt it? And I actually thank Ari Roster for sending me an article in Tehillim from Rabbi Nathaniel Helfgott. And he actually discusses this very issue. And my inclination, you can see this is from Tehillim 11. My inclination is exactly what the Chazon Ish says. However, I was quite surprised to see that others disagree. Rav Moshe Feinstein, he gives an example here of Rav Moshe Feinstein using a view that's not accepted by any of the Rishonim, but is not explicitly rejecting the Talmud. He quotes the Or Zeruah, who says that in emergency cases, you can do that as long as it's not explicitly rejected. Especially, we have a Dayan who listens to the classes who pointed out that according to Rashi, since we're dealing with a young child who converted, it's only a rabbinic prohibition anyway, and therefore there could be room for leniency. So thank you all for that. We spoke about the incident of Moshe Blau. That was last Monday, which was the fourth of that. Well, thank you, Baruch, for calling my attention to the fact that after all these years, after 74 years, the picture is finally released. It's incredible. That's Moshe Blau being taken off the ship in Italy, where he then would have passed away. Even more interesting is that the very next day in Kikar Shabbat, here you have the article, Hazilzul, the degrading of Rav Kook and its connection to the death of Moshe Blau. And they go through the whole story that I told you. They go through the fact how Rav Charlap says anyone who messed around with Rav Kook, bad things would happen to them. It talks about the things that Blau was accused of, how his son was involved in terrible things, pouring sewage on Rav Kook. His son, here's the copy of the actual Cherem that came from Ritzikas Frank's Basin, where the son of Moshe Blau, Yaakov Blau, and his brother Amram Blau were put in Cherem. So it's a whole article discussing everything we spoke about. And then at the end, the author, because this is a Haredi website, and I'm not sure why a Haredi website would be bringing this up, unless this is an internal thing to get back at the Eda Haredit. I don't know. Well, it could be like an Agudas thing to get at the Eda Haredit. But at the end, after giving all the stories and everything, he says, but it's difficult to believe it all because Moshe Blau always denied he was involved in these things. But it's a little disingenuous because the whole article is talking about what he's accused of. So really serendipitous. Okay, two more things. I'm finally getting to the point about kashrus. Okay, a couple things about kashrus. And this is a number of weeks ago, Marv from the Five Towns. Well, first, let me tell you, we've been speaking about Beit Yosef, God kosher. And wait till you hear what I found in Rav Avadya Yosef. I never noticed it before last Shabbos because it's I found it for a different reason. It's in the index. But first, here, let me share with you something. I've been talking about Beit Yosef, real got, how it's difficult to get, and Sfaradim basically don't eat it unless you live in the Deal or Brooklyn. This is my supermarket, Little West Orange, New Jersey. For the first time, I walked in yesterday, and lo and behold, I've never seen this before. They're now selling, you can see it, Beit Yosef. That's real got from Uruguay. And I guess the Sfaradim who want to be mocked on it can buy it. But it's not the only meat they're selling. They're also selling like American got. But here you have it. I think that's of interest. The next point I want to share with you, though, is a different issue. Let's take a couple of minutes. More from the Five Towns. This is going back now probably 8 weeks or more because we're class 15. I don't know what I even mentioned about kashrus. And he said that I should distinguish between politics and policy. And absolutely. But let me explain. Now, sometimes it's not clear what it is, politics or policy. First of all, the history of kashrus in America. There's a lot that can be written on it. I myself have said that I want to write about it, but there's a few books already. What I have is I have unpublished documents relating to the OK and the attacks of the rabbis against the OK. But let me show you some books on the subject, which deal with both politics and policy. This is the first one from 1974. It's now a rare book, but I was able to find a copy. Fraud, Corruption, and Holiness by Harold Gastwirth. And this really deals with the great kashrus controversies, the disputes between the rabbis. Kashrus is always a huge dispute. It meant the parnassa of rabbis. So there were unbelievable disputes. There was a lot of corruption. This is before you had VODs and the kashrus organizations. Everything was done individually. You can read all about the controversies and the conflicts and the violence. There was violence against certain rabbis who tried to enforce things. There were also politics, enormous politics. In this book, he quotes one rabbi was brought up on charges for fraudulent kashrus supervision because he was giving hashkacha to assault. I can tell you today, the OU gives hashkacha to anything people ask for. Look at your Tide detergent as an OU. They'll give anything. And in addition to politics, there's a lot of discussion of policy. For example, the Agudas Rabbanim, he discusses there because of it was very hard to, you know, there was treif being sold as kosher. So you have the whole pumbas. Anyone who's older than 45 can remember the pumbas we grew up with that they would stick onto it was the wing, so you know it was kosher. But matters got to be so bad that the Agudas Rabbanim of America made a takana, a decree, that no slaughterhouse can be given a hashkacha if it sells treif and kosher. And that decree remains in effect to this day. It wasn't accepted by everyone. There was an alternate organization called Knesset Rabbanim. And those were also big rabbis, and they refused to accept it. But this organization didn't last that long. Rav Yudel Levitz, personally spoke about, was in that organization. Rav Gavriel Zev Margolios, who was one of the biggest rabbis in New York, Talmid Chachamim was in this organization. They didn't think that you could make such a decree. But eventually it became accepted. In fact, for the whole history of kashrus in America, since the late 20s, that's been accepted. The Star K, about 15 years ago, tried to break with this. and they started giving hashgacha to a slaughtering house that also had non-kosher, and that led to all sorts of problems. In fact, in my local town, the VOD, I guess acting under instructions of the OU, removed all the Star K meat from the kosher aisle and put it with the Hebrew National stuff. In general, the Star K, as I'm sure everyone listening, if you're in America, knows, is regarded as one of the top hechsherim. It's true, there are certain in the Haredi world that don't accept it, because Rabbi Heineman has certain unusual views. One of the areas they attack him a lot is that he holds that bishalakum, there's no issue of bishalakum if you have a light in the oven. So in industrial cooking, if they have a little light, that takes care of the issue of bishalakum. And they reject that and think that's crazy. But at the end of the day, Rav Moshe Feinstein holds that industrial cooking, there's no issue of bishalakum to begin with. So that shouldn't be a problem. The big issue, which they have, is the things like the so-called, they call it the Shabbos oven. I don't know why they call it that, the Shabbos mode. It has nothing to do with Shabbos. It's Yom Tov. The Star K gives hashgacha to ovens that you could turn up and down on Yom Tov. And there's other things. But in general, the Star K is regarded as, together with the OU, the OK, the Chav K, as the CRC, as one of the big hashgachas. Another book came out in 2013, Timothy Litton. This deals with the whole issue of kashrus, government involvement in kashrus, the development of the different, all the hashkachas, and a lot with policy. I'll speak about policy in a minute. It speaks about the whole Ralbag issue here and how that became what it is. I mean, the issue of Rabbi Ralbag is something I don't understand. I've never been able to understand why in this country, Rabbi Ralbag, we're told not to eat things under hashgacha, his hashgacha. I spoke to someone in Ramosha Feinstein's family about this once, because Ramosha held of Rabbi Ralbag. And this individual, this rabbi, could not explain what the issue is. In the state of Israel, the chief rabbinate accepts Rabbi Ralbag. You go into the store and you have products with the Ishur of the chief rabbinate under Triangle K. So I don't know what the issue is. And if you're from Europe, and he was the chief rabbi of Amsterdam. So if he's no good, then the restaurant's there and the mikvah and everything. So I'm not sure. I've never been able to get an answer on this, but he discusses that as well. And very interesting book if you want to know about kashrus in America. And then the most interesting, I think, is this one. I highly recommend it. Kosher USA, How Coke Became Kosher and Other Tales of Modern Food. It discusses gelatin, jello, kosher, how Manischewitz went from a cheap American kosher item to most of its sales in the black community. It talks about the kosher organizations. It's a really quick and interesting read. And what makes it the most, I think, fascinating to me is that the author, he has no Jewish background. He can't read any of the Hebrew sources. And he must have had some good help, but he really explains correctly the gelatin issue and all the other things. So, and all these books deal with policy and politics. So what do I mean by policy? And I don't want to be cynical, because the politics, of course, is politics, but policy. So for instance, there's an enormous amount of policy. Let me just give you some examples here of policy. So for instance, in America, at least in the big cities, you'll never have a hashgacha of a bakery, let's say, that'll put hashgacha on a bakery if not everything in the bakery is kosher. So for example, the stuff in this counter is kosher and the other is not. That you won't have. And yet, if you go to Scranton, that's a small town, in the supermarket, they have a bakery there, the bagels are kosher and the other things are not. It's not even under the Scranton rabbinate. It's come out of the Vod or the rabbi in Albany. If you go to Berlin, or at least when I used to travel to Germany, you have a restaurant there, which is under Hashgacha of the Adas, which is the right wing kashrus there. And they have the wine or the liquor is not kosher. The wine, they sell non-kosher wine. I want to pull up something here so I don't forget what I wanted to tell you. They sell non-kosher wine inside the restaurant, but they have a sign there that only the food is kosher. Grossinger's, if anyone remembers Grossinger's, towards the end of Grossinger's, the dining room was kosher, but the wine was not kosher. So that's policy. Because you can make a case that we're only giving hashgacha on the food. But in the big cities, no one would do that. Big cities, they won't give hashgacha to vegetarian restaurants that are open on Shabbos, these vegetarian type of restaurants. But we have lots of restaurants in New York area and elsewhere. But if you go to small towns across America, they give hashgachas to these because people don't have much in the way of kosher food. So you have plenty of examples of policy that's important. Let me give you some. I think I found some other good examples of it. Okay, we can come up on all sorts of examples. Why was this relevant to Marv that he sent it to me? Because apparently I'm not in the five towns, but we have people listening. He wanted to know what I thought of this. This is from July 9th, so almost 2 months ago. So you have a letter here. Interesting. The five towns has a, it's a huge community, obviously, and it has a VOD. It's probably the largest Jewish community in the world that has like one VOD that basically gives all the restaurants hashgacha. Everywhere else you go, you have different kashrus organizations. So you have a letter. What happens is you have two rabbis, and we're dealing with reliable, authentic rabbis, well-respected, who they apparently want to be more strict. So they opened up their own hashgacha, and they have a few places. And you have a letter here from all the rabbis, including one of them who listens to these classes. So he's going to send me an email, I'm sure, giving his side to it, explaining that you should not eat from it. They're saying we're not saying anything bad about these rabbis, but we have a VOD, and once you start bringing in other hashgachas, it'll destroy the unity of the community. And then they say that, what do they say here? We therefore discourage the members of our community in the strongest terms from patronizing local food establishments, not another shachar divided the five towns and Far Rockaway. So, and these are the restaurants. So that would be policy, because it's not, you can't say that it's not kosher. But as a policy, if you're in the community, they're saying not to eat there. It's interesting because if, let's say, these were Satmar doing it, if a Hasidic community opened up, they wouldn't say that, because the Hasidim do their own thing. I happen to think that if you're a member of the community and you're one of these shuls, and these are all the shuls there, you should listen to the rabbis. And you shouldn't go there, because they're trying to create this one standard. Although I was surprised to see in the letters to the editor from people in the five towns, if you read the story, they're all, the attacks, it's all about shock that the VOD would push for people not to go to restaurants they can't make money off. Can't believe they'll publish this letter in the 70th Thomas. They're talking about how it's un-American to have monopolies, et cetera, et cetera. But I get it. And if I was living in the five towns, I think this is a good policy, if as long as you can control it. However, I also think, and I hope my friend who's listening won't disagree with me, but for those of us who don't live in the five towns, it's not, I don't think it's an issue. It's a communal issue. It's policy. You want to make sure you have a strong VOD, but I don't live there. If I come to the five towns and I see a restaurant and it's under someone else who's reliable, I don't feel that I need to follow that policy. We had an example like this in Bergen County. Bergen County also has a very nice VOD. And they give hashgacha to everything, but they have something called the doghouse, the Teaneck doghouse. The VOD refused to give hashgacha to this restaurant. Many of you listening know the Teaneck doghouse because it's a sports bar. It's open like to 2 a.m. or something Saturday night. They didn't think it would be a good place for Jews to hang out in. So they had the hashgacha of Rav Zusha Blech, then he passed away. Now it's under the OU. So that's policy. So we have to distinguish always between policy and policy has impact on halacha. Many halacha decisions are based on policy. Rav Herschel Schechter just came out with new Corona tshuva, and he spoke about davening on Ma'ariv. You're outside and you can't get people to come back from Ma'ariv at night. You can't see. He said that you can daven Ma'ariv after Plag. So you can daven Ma'ariv at 7, let's say 7:15, you can daven Ma'ariv. But Shabbos isn't over for almost another hour. So Rav Schechter says, if you, in practice, you have to ask the local rabbi. If the rabbi, because you might have a situation where people think that all of a sudden Shabbos is over, you daven Ma'ariv. But technically he says, if this is the only way you can get a minyan, you can daven Ma'ariv before Shabbos is over. So that's policy. Technically you can, but policy, it might not be a good thing. And that's always been a part of halacha, and it's not politics. It's policy. Okay, there's more to talk about, but I want to stop this because I want to keep going. Oh, one more thing, though, which I I found over Shabbos, which relates to the kashrus. In the Yabia Omer, we spoke about kitnios, we spoke about kashrus. This is in the index, the table of contents. It's not in the book itself. And I've been reading through recently the table of contents because Rav Avadia, I only recently became aware of the fact, I always knew he wrote the table of contents, but he actually puts in stuff in the table of contents that aren't in the responsa. I think it's when he finished the book and he wanted to just add it in. And if you look in volume 5, Siman 37, he deals with the question of an Ashkenazi woman who's married to a Sephardic man. And when she goes to her father's house, her parents' house, I should say, she doesn't eat kitniot, of course, because she's in her parents' house. Everything else the Ashkenazim do, but now she's married. When she's with her husband, can she eat kitniot? And of course, Rav Avadia Yosef says 100%. She's married, so she takes her the minhagim of her husband. And he also says that if she doesn't, if she wants to be so-called pious and doesn't want to get meals, he says it'll destroy Shalom Bayit. And he said, certainly in Eretz Yisrael, you have to follow the practice of the Sephardim. She's married to a Sephardi. Okay, that we can get. I don't think anything surprising here, although some of you might be surprised that Rav Avadia says you're not even supposed to, a woman who grew up Ashkenazi who's married to a Sephardi, he doesn't think she should be strict. But then he says, and this is in brackets, you have a Sephardic woman who grew up, of course, eating kitniot, and now she's married to an Ashkenazi. Rav Avadia says, in the house of her husband, it's not proper for her to eat kitniot. He doesn't say it's forbidden. He says it's not proper. But then he says, remember, a Sephardic woman in Israel married to an Ashkenazi man, and it's in Israel, not in Chutzaretz, because Israel is, as Rav Avadia thinks, under the control of the Sephardic approach. When she goes to her father's house, she could eat kitnios there. That's an incredible thing. He's saying, halacha l'maisa, that all Sephardic women married to Ashkenazi, when they're not at home, when they go to their family, or I guess maybe even when they leave their house or on the street, they can eat kitnios. It only binds them when they're living together with their husband, because we do not say that she accepted upon herself a minhag Ashkenaz. And then he says, and she is not allowed, even though she comes from a Sephardic background, Michael Ashkenazi, she can't eat regular kosher. She can only eat Beit Yosef, which, talk about destroying Shalom Bayit. Rav Avadia Yosef is so strict on this thing. He's saying that the woman, even though she's married to an Ashkenazi, she doesn't follow her husband's practices. I don't know how he'd answer the problem about Shalom Bayit. If a husband wants to eat regular OU meat, and he says only Beit Yosef. But it's incredible both ways, that being married to an Ashkenazi does not mean remove you from the obligation to eat Beit Yosef. And two, that a Sephardic woman can still eat kitnios, even though she's married to an Ashkenazi. Okay, everyone, let us now pick up. We're continuing. In the Igros Malche Rabbanan, we have some interesting stuff today. We're picking up on page 150, Siman Samach Bet, 62. Thank you all, by the way, for all the comments and number of people. I think there's now in the first class on YouTube has about 935 views. So people are watching that. Very nice. Okay, the first thing I want to show you is as follows. Maybe you, we've spoken about this woman in the past. I've written about her. Kultum. Kultum. Here it says it, was an Egyptian singer-songwriter, blessed with a beautiful voice and a wine rage. She was undoubtedly the greatest female Arabic singer in history. Massive following. If you read the book, wonderful book, highly recommended. We've spoke about Egypt last class. The Man in the White Sharkskin Suit. The woman, the author who wrote it, mentions that she had heard the rumors that her father had an affair with Kultum. She's Jewish, obviously. Not Kultum, the woman who wrote about her family, the man in the, what's it called, the man in the white shark skin. So it's all about this family from Egypt who comes to America. It's really, it's a great Shabbos read. Now, She was very popular in the Jewish community as well. Cantors, chazanim, used her tunes for tefillot. And Chacham Ovadia Yosef was a great lover of her music. Now this, I had a problem with this. At least I didn't understand something because, where's my Bia Omera? If you look at all the discussions of the issue of Kol Isha, listening to a female singer, they all, including Rabbi Boech, they all quote Ravad Yosef as saying that if you know what she looks like, it's still Kol Isha, even if it's not live. Well, this was obviously a problem because we know, and this is not something that we just know from like rumors. Ravad Yosef's students speak about this. He would listen to her in the car, and sometimes he would curse her. He liked her music, but he would curse her sometimes. I guess he thought she was an anti-Semite. So it's I didn't know what to make of this. Now, but it's not that they make this up, Ravadia holds this. If you look at Yabia Omer, Volume 1, Orachayim, number 6, that's what he says. He writes, he concludes the tshuva saying, if the Biyodo Makira, Afil Eidei Tzmuna, if you know who this person is, even on a picture, it's forbidden to hear on a gramophone, I guess that's like a record player or a radio. So how did that work? How does he say one thing and do something else? After I wrote the letter that I wrote to Rav Avraham Yosef, we'll see in a second, I think I might have found the answer to it different than what he says, once again, in the index, in the table of contents. In the table of contents, this is what Chacham Avraham Yosef says. Kol zemer shel isha beradio gramophone, the voice of a woman, he says, Ein tzarech lizaher milishamo b'shak kriyat shmo tefila. There's no problem in listening to it during Kriyat Shema Tefila, Kasheinu Makir at the Mashuret, if you don't recognize the singer, and it's not Kol Bisha Erva. There's two ways of understanding this issue of Kol Bisha Erva. It's whether it's at all times or whether it's only during Kriyat Shema and during Kriyat Shema in particular, but Tefila as well. What does that mean? It means if it's enticing, licentious, that's a separate issue. It has nothing to do with Kol Isha. That just is about the raising of hear her. But the prohibition of Kol Isha, which is a stomp prohibition, you see in plenty of Rishonim, it only applies in Kriyat Shema. And that is the justification, for instance, of listening to the singing of national anthems and songs that are not enticing. You can read in the recent tradition, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein has a whole piece on it. That sort of has gone out of most of the Orthodox world, except for some of the modern Orthodox high schools. But this was an opinion. And Rav Mordechai Tendler told me that Rav Moshe held of this opinion. And based on that, Rav Mordechai Tendler gave the Hetter to Neshama Karlbach to sing. And when she used to sing, the ad would be for Orthodox groups. The ad would say, for those for whom it's permissible to listen, this is what time it's going to be, etc. So now I'm thinking that maybe that's the reason Ravadia held only sexual enticing songs were prohibited, and all other singing was only a problem if it's not during Kriyat Shema. But at the time I wrote my letter to this individual who we've heard about already, where is he? Rav Avraham Yosef, I didn't see that in the index. What I'm going to read you now is fascinating because it's pretty much not known, even though I subsequently saw that Rav Avraham Yosef says it in a couple, two lines later in a volume of the Tshuva. And when I say it's not known, it was just about a year ago, I think it was. I heard Rabbi Chaim Jachter from Teaneck. He writes a lot about Sephardic halacha, and he quoted the standard view of Avraham Yosef. So here I'll just read you. It's titled the Tshuva Shmiat Zemarisha, listening to a woman sing. And I asked Rav Avraham Yosef this problem. I said that in volume one, number 6, he only says you can listen if you can't hear. And what about the fact that kultum? How do you make sense of that? So he says to me, I'm surprised he didn't think it was a chutzav question. He didn't, because I said, this isn't something that, you know, some rumor. This is public knowledge. Davar yodu with the Chacham Avadia loved kultum. So he answered me, and he said that, and he didn't give the answer I gave about the table of contents. He says that it's true in this tshuva, my father, this is from 2010. He says, my father is strict that if you know what she looks like, you have to forbid it. He says, but after speaking with him about this matter a few times, he became more lenient. And he says, it's not a problem unless it's a live performance. That's really interesting testimony of Rav Avraham Yosef saying his father changed his mind, but we'd have to know when was Chacham Avadi Yosef listening to Kultum when he lived in Egypt. That takes us back to 1948. I'm not sure. The first volume here was published in 1954. I don't know when he started listening to her, but that's what he says. He changed his mind. He says it has to do with hear horror. And if it doesn't lead to hear horror, he says, if it's not a live performance, or it doesn't mean to say live, where you see actual TV or whatever, he says it's not a prohibition. Now, in my note, I found something in volume 9. Chacham Avadi Yosef himself says that even though earlier I wrote that if you see in the picture, it's a problem, he says it's not true. He says, I changed my mind. So that answers it. I have to say that since Chacham Avadi Yosef and the son both say that Avadi Yosef changed his mind, I don't know what to make of the table of contents, where the table of contents is specific in volume 1, that the issue is only Kriyat Shema. Maybe the table of contents there, I should say, was written by someone else. Generally, we assume that he wrote the table of contents, or maybe it wasn't in exact language. But here you have a significant change of Avadi Yosef's position, which is also attested to in the Abi Omer, but it's just, it's in volume 9, Orachaim, Kufchet, Osmem, Gimel, but it's just like 3 lines. So no one really knows about this. And it really creates the need for rewriting Rav Avadi Yosef's position on this matter, because just go online and Google, you'll see that everyone who presents his view presents it in accord with the view that is incorrect. So that is Simon Samach Beis. Okay. Now we're up to Samach Gimel. Actually, skip Samach Gimel because we'll hear the same thing in Samach Dalet. Samach Dalet, we're going to see a responsum for also someone we saw already, Rabbi Moshe Malka from Morocco, Casablanca, chief rabbi of Petach Tikva, author of 6 volumes of responsa called Mikveh Hamayim. These orange type of books, Mikveh Hamayim, this is volume 4, 6 volumes. And then for some reason, for the 7th volume, he published it as a different name, Veheshiv Moshe. His name is Moshe. So Moshe replied. This tshuva, which I'm going to talk about now, is actually somewhat famous. It's one of the most famous in the book because and if you Google it, you'll see, and you'll understand why it's one of the most famous. I think I, did I pull it up here? No, I didn't save it, but you'll see why. Because it deals with this great rabbi that we've spoken about, we'll speak again more and more, Rabbi Yosef Masas, chief rabbi of Haifa from I think 71 or something, maybe 1970. Even in the 60s, maybe late 60s, but he was rabbi in Meknes and before that in Tlemcen, Algeria, with all sorts of interesting ideas. There's a little book about Rav Yosef Masas. I showed you already. Chaim Amsalem has a book on him. There's a master's dissertation at Bar Ilan. Everyone is interested in Rav Yosef Masas because of his unusual views. And I tell you that in 1989, 1990, when I first discovered him, he was basically unheard of except for in the Moroccan community. There's a couple streets in Israel named after him. Now there was even a conference a couple of years ago devoted to him. You can see it on YouTube. How did I discover him? I was in the Harvard Library in 1989, and I saw a bright red book. This isn't usually what most books look like. So I opened it up, and it's called Mayim Chayim. I've never heard of the author, Yosef Masas, Rav Rashi from Haifa. Oh, I'm sorry, it says from 1963, he's the chief rabbi. published in 1985. I never heard of them, and I take the book home. I remember I took it home over Shabbos, and I'm reading through it, and the tshuvot are really interesting, not your normal type of thing. Well, we could have a whole, we did a couple classes on him, and I wrote a piece for Mark Angel's online journal about him, but there's so much you can say about him. And then I'm looking through it, and lo and behold, I come up to Orach Chaim Siman Kufiyot, and we already saw it. It's the same tshuva, incidentally, that he spoke about Rishus HaRabim that we dealt with already. And the question is, on what do the wives of Shochtim and Mokim and even the wives of Dayanim rely not to cover their hair? And this is 1955 when he's on the Beis Din, one of the big rabbis in Meknes. And so it's a short tshuva in which he makes the argument that this is only societal. There's no real obligation in a society where women generally don't cover their hair. It's not an obligation. And this view, of course, became well known in the last 15 years by Yosef Vasas. No one really knew about it in this book. Not only that, I didn't even know at the time. He has a book called Otsar HaMichtovim, which I could not get. Not only could I couldn't get volume one of his book. I was able to contact his son in Israel, who found a family member who had an extra copy who sent it to me, because it was printed first in Meknes. It's one of the only books printed in Meknes. Most books are printed in Casablanca. As I recall, it's, well, check that. As I recall, it's, hold on a second. I don't want to say anything that's incorrect. I'll just, these days you can check everything very quickly. Mayim Chaim, if you go on Otsar Chachma that I have in front of me, you'll see, yes, Mayim Chaim, there's the first volume I'm looking at. Printed in Fez, yes. Fez, no books really were printed in Fez. So he was able, the son, he passed away a couple of years ago, Eliyahu Misas, he was able to get from his family, not they reprinted it again in the 60s, get me a copy of volume one. I could not for the life of me get Otsar HaMichtovim, and I saw that he also has a long response, and a very long one, many, many pages, dealing with the same issue in Otsar HaMichtovim. Then fortunately they reprinted it in the World Sephardic Library, Sifri HaSfaradit. If you ever need Sephardic works, so they have it in 1998. It looks like this. I love, this is an incredible book, the Otsar HaMichtovim, three volumes with history and stories and folklore and halacha, everything. Okay, so my question was, and I wrote to Rabbi Malka, well, was this a view of his generally accepted? Morocco, what was the story in Morocco? I could talk all about the situation in Lithuania and the yeshiva world, et cetera, in America, but this, I had never known that this was an issue in Morocco. And I'm not interested in the masses. Obviously, the masses were not that observant in, once the French came in and started with the French influence, but I'm interested in the rabbis. There's actually two tshuvot from Rav Malka to me, and if you Google it, you'll see there's a lot of discussion for obvious reasons. People want to latch on, who want lenient approaches, they want to latch on to it. So he replies to me, and this is was printed in Veheshiv Moshe, his responsa. He says that I wrote to him, and what's the story with Rav Misas's tshuva in Mayim Chaim, where that Bizman Hazeh Shekol Nashei Olam Chazru Gosev Roshan Pak Isurah, that since the women no longer cover their hair, there's no longer a prohibition. Is this something one can rely on, and how did they do it in Morocco? And he begins by saying that originally I too found this difficult because the Gemara says Rosh HaPuro Daraisai, it's a Torah prohibition. But then he goes on that after investigating it, et cetera, et cetera, I see that it's societally based. He explains his whole argument. And then he concludes that therefore the position of Rav Misas is that it's Hadavar Toloi B'minhag, that the whole thing, it all depends on local practices. And if the women in the city decide that they're going to uncover their hair, there's no longer an issue of hir hor. And he says, presumably that's what the people rely on today when they don't cover their hair. This is what I call when rabbis, they assume that everything the masses do, they rely on what the rabbis say. It's maybe the rabbis do, but the masses do what they want. And then he concludes the last paragraph, Etzlenu b'chutz la'aretz, in chutz la'aretz, among us in Morocco, it was galoyim aforsam that all the women would go b'giloy rosh, except for the charediot. The charediot would be the very religious, the super religious, who would wear a pe'ah nachrit, or they would wear a wig, or they'd wear a kerchief. Hold on a second. I got to turn off my sound for a second. I'm hearing some sound behind me, so I got to shut it off. I had to shut it off. Okay. And then he continues. Even those who were machmir, that is, who did wear the shadel, knew that the women in Morocco were not going to listen to them to cover their hair, and therefore they didn't protest it because of it's better that they be unwitting sinners. And then he goes on to say, would that the only thing they uncover is the hair, because today people walk down the streets with all sorts of immodest dress, mixed swimming, the whole bit. And he says, but here you have Rav Moshe Malka, chief rabbi of Petach Tikva. Let's pull this picture up again. Deciding halacha l'maisa in accord with Rabbi Yosef Masas. So that itself is significant because although we don't have much in the way of written tshuvot with this position, there is an American tshuva I'll mention in a second. But I wrote another letter to Rabbi Malka because I found what I thought was a stira in his letter. He begins at the end there. He says that the women didn't cover their hair, and he says it's only a minhag; they don't have to. But then he says that the religious, the very religious, would not rebuke the women who didn't, because mutav shu shogigim, better that they be unwitting sinners. And he cites Hilchos Yom Kippurim, or Chaim. That's where the Ramah speaks about that when you have to rebuke someone, if it's Torah prohibition, you do. If it's rabbinic, you don't. But the assumption of the concept of mutav shu shogigin, better unwitting sinners, assumes that they're sinning, but since they're not going to listen to you, don't rebuke them. So my question is, what's going on here? First, you say that Rav Masas is right, that it's not a halachic matter, but then in the end, you say that you quote the idea that better not to rebuke them because they're not going to listen. That implies it is a prohibition. And he says, it's not a stira. He doesn't even know how I came to a stira. And he says that there are things that some people accept, others don't. He says, for instance, in this very matter, Chacham Avad Yosef opposes shadels. He thinks shadels are forbidden. And he says correctly, he says that shadels could be nicer than natural hair. And then he says, and then other people, then you have Rav Masas' position on the other side. He says, I first explained Rav Masas' position that in contemporary times, there's no obligation for hair covering. And then he says, I gave justification, halachic justification. And then I said, but not everyone agrees with it. There are those who are machmir and they still believe you have to cover. And he's saying it was regarding those people who do wear the shadels, all the Chabadniks of Morocco. Chabad was very important there. I am explaining why those people and those rabbis who did think it was halacha, why they too did not rebuke. It's because they, and that's when I brought in the argument of mutav shogi, because they held better an unwitting sinner than a sinner. But he holds halacha lamaisa that it's not an obligation. And I sent him the author, he was the rabbi of Hartford, Connecticut, Rabbi Yitzhak Hurwitz. His son was a professor of political science at Columbia, Jacob S. Hurwitz. But he has this very important work called Yad HaLevi. It's a commentary on the Sefer of Mitzvos. And right in the middle, you wouldn't expect it, he goes on 2 pages explaining the same approach as Rav Masas about covering the hair. Supposedly the Rav of Soloveitchik thought very highly of the Yad HaLevi. His book was also recently printed. So here you have two tshuvot of the Malka testifying to at least what was the situation in Morocco and what he, as a rabbi and as a posek, thought about this matter. As I said, if you Google this, you'll see many people who cite Rabbi Malka's tshuva for their own reasons, obviously. So that's number 64 and 65. Then we get to number 66. 66 is a letter to me from this individual, Rabbi Shlomo Dayan, who was a member of the Knesset, of the Shas party, also from Morocco. He's from Tetuan, also a Talmud Chacham. I just got to show, before I show you his book, last year, 2 years ago, they reprinted the Tshuvot of Rav Masas. Instead of 2 volumes, 4 volumes, beautiful volumes, which they put in all sorts of other stuff, from manuscript, halachic writings. You can get it, if you're interested, at the Mizrahi's bookshop in Brooklyn. But this Shlomo Dayan, he wrote this book. Big, thick book here, Ateret Shlomo. I find it of great significance or importance for my work because he records lots of practices in Morocco. In fact, on the title page itself, it says, Birei Halachot V'Chikrei Minhagim Al Pi Minhag HaMaarav HaPanimi. Halachic discussions and investigations of Minhagim based on the Minhag of Ma'arav HaPanimi. That's how you say Morocco in rabbinic literature. So why did I write to him? Well, he is the editor of the Mayim Chaim, Volume 2. Where Rav Yosef Masas gives his position on women's hair covering. And I wanted to ask him the same question I asked Rav Moshe Malka, although he grew up in Israel. He came on Aliyah by dying when he was young. I wanted to ask him the same thing. And he says as follows to me. He says, we've never heard of anyone who permitted this. So he's rejecting Rav Masas. He says, Yesh l'lameid schus, Muhammad Schluss on Rav Masas, that everything he did was L'shem Shemayim. He wanted to find a permission, L'zmano Olimkom. He wanted to find some way of justifying the fact that everyone was, all the women were doing that. But don't rely on Halach L'masa. And then he says as follows, Af ani hatsa'ir yesh li tsar sheipasti et hapsak anizkar vo himash nishmatti medifus. Rabbi Dayan says that I regret publishing this. I should have censored it. I should have left it out. In this case, we're fortunate that had he left it out and had he censored it, it wouldn't have mattered because we have in the Mayim, in the Otzer Michtovim, we have it's like a 4-page response in great detail where Rav Masas explains his position. The Mayim Chaim is just one paragraph. But here, this is, I think, a significant testimony that I wrote a whole book on censorship. Here you have Rabbi Dayan saying that he made a mistake. He should have censored. Now, why should he have censored? Why should he have taken it out if Rav Masas wrote it? Because of the idea that we don't accept what Rav Masas says, and therefore we don't want people to know about this because then people might rely on it or this and that. Everyone has their own reasons. This, unfortunately, is a phenomenon that we can't do more than we can do. I mean, we have to deal with the books we have. But none of us know when books are published what is included and what is not included. And I tried to open a window onto this, and we have plenty of examples. When volumes are published by descendants, they refuse to include things that they think are going to be problematic. And here Rabbi Dayan acknowledges that he made a mistake, he thinks, and by including it. It's hard to see how it's a mistake if Rav Masas wanted to include it. You know that this is a tendency. We have a book, Collections of the Writings of the Aruch HaShulchan, and the editor in the introduction says he wasn't sure whether he should include the Aruch HaShulchan's response on permitting using electricity on Yom Tov. And he asked Rav Chaim Kanievsky, and Rav Chaim Kanievsky said, no, you should include everything. But had Rav Chaim Kanievsky said, no, don't include it, or had he decided on his own, which is often the case, not to include it, then that would be an example of what I'm talking about, that they have covering up views that are not, acceptable in quotes today. But that's, there you see Rav Yosef Masas, he's known for this position. That's what he's known for. That's what everyone knows him for, the women's hair covering. But we could sit here and we could talk for weeks and weeks about him, his originality in so many areas. And we'll come back to him as well. He says, I had asked him as well, did people in Morocco you know, rely on Rav Masas, and he says that the those people who ma'adifim, this is Rav Moshe Malka, ma'adifim kochot teru, those people who prefer leniency, heritzu oto, they admired him. Those who didn't, of course, who had a stringent side, were big opposition to him. And you even had at least one rabbi in Morocco who engaged in polemics with him. He wrote a book, Achashomo, as I recall, that's the one. Very harsh things against Rav Masas. The people who opposed Rav Masas used to call him Yosef HaMatir, Yosef the lenient. That's a play on Yosef HaMashbir. And then he says, but those of us who are great lovers of Rav Yosef Masas, Komashakata Kasav Kadoshu, you know, it's all holy. But he says the people who reject Rav Yosef Masas, he calls them Ego HaMitchastim. What is mitchasei? Mitchasei, this term appears already in medieval times. It doesn't mean a chassid. It means one who tries to be pious, outwardly pious, one who wears it on his sleeve, one who acts pious. He says, ve'eu ha-mitchastim o'avei ha-chumrot. The ones who love the chumras, they don't like him. He says, achein hu'chachu amid b'chodor v'dor. This is in every generation. So we have time for one more. Simon Samach Zion takes us back to Rabbi Rasabi. I don't have his picture. I didn't think we'd get to him this far today, but we've spoken about him already. And, you know, I didn't really prepare the tshuva. There's a few things I want to say. It's a response to Rabbi Yehuda Ratzel Henkin, because Rabbi Yehuda Ratzel Henkin cited earlier texts that speak about mixed dancing and kosher mixed dancing. I think I need to frame that whole issue so you know what I'm talking about. Today, you're sitting here, mixed dancing. How could you ever have mixed dancing at religious events? But you'll see it's not so pashut. Furthermore, I'll even show you next week at Hasidic weddings. Standard, you have mixed dancing. Every Hasidic wedding of certain groups, you have mixed dancing. Not of everyone, but of the Hassan and Kala. When I say mixed dancing, wait till you see the videos. It'll blow you away. So we'll see what Rav Ratzabi says about this. We'll talk about the mitzvah tants a little, the Hasidic thing, and the different approaches to the mitzvah tants, and what Rav Henkin says, and why Rav Henkin would have thought that it said what he said. But that'll have to wait for next week. Then we're going to get into the interesting questions that about bat mitzvahs. That I was hired, I'll tell you the story from the organization Eidah to ask big rabbis about. And so let me get to, it's already 9:23, so let me get to some questions and comments. Time went fast. Let's see, chats here. The Sotsbach say, from Amsterdam, we know that during Rabbi 10 years there in Amsterdam, the Dutch Hashkacha was always under the supervision of Rabbi Just and not trying okay. Rabbi Yust signed off on Hechsheri. But correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, Rabbi Rabag was the Rav of Amsterdam, so he was the official Rav of Amsterdam, so I'm assuming that he has something to do with it as well. In any event, I'll tell you something else about Rabbi Rabag. His conversions are accepted by the Israeli chief rabbinate. So I'm not sure about someone, don't write it in the chat, but if anyone knows, you can send me, email me privately, if anyone knows what the issue is with Rabbi Ralbag. Yes, Triangle K has nothing to do with Europe. Triangle K is an American thing. And Rabbi Ralbag is the rabbi of the young Israel of the Avenue K in Brooklyn, but he would fly over, even when he was, first he was there permanently. And he's the one who did the Erev as well. But then he would, he's the one who did the Erev. I think he had a dispute with Rabbi Yost actually on the Erev. The Amsterdam Erev is the oldest continuous Erev, but it's probably not continuous.
Excuse.
Hello. He did the Erev, I know Rabbi Ralbag, but it wasn't Triangle K when he was there. Triangle K is American. But if you're correcting me that he was not, wasn't charged with Ashkachas, he lived there, but then he also was living in America and he would fly there. I don't know how often he would fly there to do it. He told me a whole story once. I'll tell you another time. Do you want to just say something quickly about Amsterdam because you're from there? I just know what he told me. I don't know.
It's he lived there.
Yeah.
From 75 to 83. He was held a permanent basis. He had a shtelle. He had a shul, one of the big shuls he had. And at that time, he got into a tremendous machlokes with Rav Yust, because Rav Yust had assert the Eruv, and he wrote a whole the treatise and a teshuva on it, and that he was matir it. So there were many conflicts, but in any case he was not involved in kashrus at
then. That was from 75 to 83.
Yeah, from 75 to 83. Then he left with lots of machlokes, but he got a shtelle in Young Israel Avenue K. And in the early 2000s, he was brought back on a
fly-in basis.
But then when he was brought back, he was the Rav Amachshir of all the restaurants, right?
That's possible. That's possible.
Because he was the official Rav of Amsterdam.
It was the Rabbi Les era.
They flew him in every 3 weeks for a week or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I'm referring to. He was then the official Rav then. His tshuva on the Erev actually has the Haskama of the Tzitz Eliezer. And and some other rabbis. Yeah. So it was an improvement, he told me, from Rabbi Duner's Erev, which was earlier on.
Yeah.
This Erev originally goes back to the Chacham Tzvi in certain
forms.
Thank you for that clarification. I was only speaking about when he was later on, when he was the fly-in rabbi.
Yeah, no, but...
okay, so thank you for that, Sulzbachs. Around 2000 or so, Omaha Steaks was offering kosher as well as non-kosher meats. According to the literature I read at the time, there were two separate rooms or maybe separate buildings for kosher and non-kosher. But that's a problem. According to the Agudas Rabbanim, you said that if an animal was taken to the kosher room, slaughtered and inspected, if it passed, the hindquarter was moved to the non-kosher room and the rest was left for processing. If it failed, the entire animal was moved to the non-kosher room. Every time you shecht and it's non-kosher, you get rid of it and you sell it to the non-kosher. But to actually have the slaughterhouse I don't know what they do in the slaughterhouses today when it's found non-kosher. If they, I think based on the takana, they can't prepare it as treif and sell it. But in the old slaughterhouses in America, before the Agudas Rabbanim made its decree, they would then do exactly what you're describing, and they would they would sell it. I don't know who gave Ashkacha Larry to Omaha Steaks, because according to the Agudas Rabbanim, the OU would never allow kosher and non-kosher from the same, unless it's different once you shecht it. But the early decree was you had slaughterhouses that would slaughter treif on one side, and then you'd have kosher on the other side, and they'd get confused. So the Agudas Rabbanim made a takana policy that you can't do that. But obviously, every slaughterhouse is going to have non-kosher, because after they shecht it, it's non-kosher. So you need to have a system to you move it. But that's the diavad. It's not l'chachtila to have kosher and non-kosher in the same room. That's what they don't allow. What they do have is they have got and non-got. Today, as we know, the OU only give hashgacha on what they call got. So what happens to all the meat that's non-got? Well, I don't know what happens now, but as of a few years ago, the meat and it was shechted that was found to be non-got was sold, I think it was even sold in Trader Joe's, under the hashgacha of Rabbi Zeilengold from Minnesota. He's a Chabad rabbi. But as it was explained to me, and if anyone's from Minnesota, you can clarify, these were OU mashgichim, OU shochtim. It's just that when it came out, not got, OU got, which allows a few sirchot, they didn't do, all they did was then put it over on the side, and then it was sold under the Ashkacha of Rabbi Zeilengold, but Rabbi Zeilengold had nothing to do with it. That it was completely OU, but the OU wouldn't put their Hashkacha on it. So basically it was OU meat, and if you trust the OU, you could eat it. There wouldn't be a problem. That's how it was explained to me, but I don't know. Mel says, was the author of The Man with the White Shark Skin, who passed away at the year of 62. I do remember that. That she did, unfortunately young, but it's a great a Shabbos book. So Baruch, it repeats what we said about what we just heard from the Sulzbachs. in Amsterdam. I'll tell you something, Rabbi Ralbag. I asked him about this once. I think this is great. I said to him that certain, you know, in the modern Orthodox world, they don't eat Yiddish. I don't know how I had the chutzpah to say this to him, but I wanted to try to get to the bottom of this thing. What happens is I spoke to him a number of times, and I even had him interview his father for me. If you Google Rabbi Sfarimbag, Rabbi Ralbag, Mark Shapiro, Mordechai Kaplan, you'll see I have the whole story of the burning of Mordechai Kaplan's sitter. It was actually done by Rabbi Ralbag Sr. And contrary to what J.J. Schachter writes in his book and other people, that this is really the Agudas Rabbanim burning it, and then when everything became a controversy, they said they knew nothing about it. It's not true. It was Rabbi Ralbag Sr. himself decided he was going to burn this sitter, and he didn't tell anyone in the Agudas Rabbanim. And this was they had the big cheirim in the hotel with all the rabbis there, and they put the sitter in cheirim. Then Yosef Ralbag gets up and he lights it on fire and burns it. And so I had Rabbi Ralbag Junior, Ravi Ralbag, interview his father on my behalf about this. So I had a number of conversations with him, and we spoke about the Erev, spoke about his kosher standards and certain heterim he has from Rebbe Yoshev and others. It's very interesting conversations for another time. But then I asked him, well, what about, how do you make sense of this, that the modern Orthodox rabbis don't allow your stuff, and the modern Orthodox communities don't eat your food? And he says to me, Bazeh HaLashon, in these words, so word for word, basically, he says, those people go mixed swimming and they don't trust my kashrus. And then he continued cursing him out or something. But he goes, they go mixed swimming and they have the chutzpah not to trust my kashrus. So that's what he said. Regarding the Schultzbox, regarding Rabbi Yust, someone from Amsterdam who's been listening to the classes just emailed me a couple weeks ago. He wanted to know whether there was any contact with Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg and Rabbi Yust, if I knew of anything. And Michael Broyd. Michael Broyd. Well, Michael Broyd uses Rabbi Massas, and he uses Rabbi Moshe Malka as well. David Eisen asks, Moshe Malka, scientist Shuvot with Hatzvi Moshe Malka. Hatzir, what is Hatzvi? Hatzir Ba'alfa Yisrael. That's it comes from Tanakh. Wasn't a Rav Massas chief rabbi of Jerusalem? That is Rav Shalom Massas, who we've spoken about a number in the early classes. A much more significant figure, Rav Shalom Massas. He was chief rabbi of Casablanca and then of all of Morocco. And in 1979, he comes to Eretz Yisrael. And if you go back a few classes, you'll hear the class about donating to a church, as well as other tshuvot. And I think there's one more from him as well. He was the cousin, even though he's significantly younger, he was a cousin of... sorry, David, you're right. Not that he Googled it. Not Hatzir Ba'alfei Yisrael, Hatzir Ba'alfei Yehuda. Although I'm thinking... if anyone uses it, sometimes you get expressions that begin one way, and they change. So, for instance, we're saying "I said Hatzir Ba'alfei Yisrael," but the biblical verse is, and someone could look it up where it is. It's a biblical verse. Hatzir Ba'alfei. Yeah, if you look at my book here, it gives Hatzir Ba'alfei Yisrael as an option. Hold on, I believe, I'll check right here where this, it's in Micha, it's called Tzair Liop Alfei Yehuda, but it's become Tzair Ba'alfei Yisrael as well. That's even listed first in my Otsar Rashi Tevos. For example, how do you say, if someone wants, something bad could happen, they say, lo aleichem. So people today will abbreviate it lamed ayin, or they'll say lo aleichem with an ayin. Actually, it's in Tanakh, it's a pasuk, it's lo aleichem. But it's become, hold on, if I just quickly, I'll see here, I don't know where it is. I believe it's Aleinu, it's entire something. It's one of those things. But it's definitely with a, you'd have to look it up. I can't look it up while I'm with you. But it's the biblical term is with an aleph, lo'alechem lo'aleinu. Barry says young Israel had mixed dances when my parents met. And young Israel's, first of all, began without, they didn't want the rabbis. So then they had the rabbis. But young Israel's obviously had mixed dances. Not just young Israel. So every single modern Orthodox shul had mixed dances. Young Israel is significant because young Israel was always strictly Orthodox, at least in its constitution, and in ways that others weren't. For example, you had to have mechitza. Many so-called Orthodox shuls, and they were Orthodox shuls, but they were Orthodox shuls without mechitzas. They were members of the OU. The Young Israel never had that. And yes, they had dances, and one of the last ones, KJ, I don't think KJ still has a dance, but when I lived in the Upper West Side in the 90s, KJ still had the dance, and the Young Israel, the Jewish Center of New York, Upper West Side, had till I think when Rabbi Schachter left, that's in the 90s, they got rid of the dance. We're going to go back, though, 400 years into Italy. And there's takanas of the great rabbis about the dances. So the question is how to understand these takanot. Are these takanot, like Rav Ratzabi will tell you, that this is, we'll see next week, the rabbis couldn't control matters entirely, so they tried to do the best they could by limiting the dancing to the ways we'll see. Or is it like Rav Henkin, who sees this, that in a different society, they didn't see this as a problem for a husband and wife to do a dance, especially the dances we're talking about were these like, I don't know what you call them, not square dances, but you think back to like the Habsburgs. Like they would do these dances like 200 years ago or Jane Austen. It's like you walk forward a step, you walk back a step. It's I'm not even talking about waltzes here. So we'll get to that next week. Someone texted me privately that his understanding, the reason he's not relying on Rabbi Ralbag is that he doesn't provide the criteria that serves as the basis of his kosher standards. I actually asked him about that because I was told that. And he said, no, that's not true. And I personally asked him about certain things and he explained it to me. He explained to me about a certain thing of kosher he does that he says from Rav Yashiv. So that seems, that apparently is just a legend. Then I was told by someone that that he doesn't eat his own meat. Someone else said, there's someone in my town, he thought that Rabbi Ralbag was a conservative rabbi. So he went to MTA and then he went off to Eretz Yisrael and learned in the big yeshivas. His son is a rabbi in the five towns. I guess he'll take over the Hashgacha. He says it's not true. He eats his meat, all these things. I don't know what the basis of it is. Maybe he does rely on certain kulas that others don't rely on. It could be. But the idea that he doesn't tell you what they are, he told me, after he got annoyed with me, or annoyed with the modern Orthodox for not accepting his kashrus, I spoke to him more about it, and I said, well, maybe it has something to do with gelatin. And he agreed that maybe it does, because he told me his father was also, we're talking about big Talmid HaChachamim, his father has a whole commentary on the Smak, the Sefer Mitzvot Kotlin. His father was a student of Ritzi Pesach Frank. When you say a Talmud, it's not like Ritzi Pesach Frank had a yeshiva that he went to, but in Jerusalem, he would always go to Ritzi Pesach Frank to ask him a shaylas, and he referred to his father as a Talmud. And Ritzi Pesach Frank held the gelatin was mutter. So when he came to America in the early years, he told me, not now, not for the last 30 years, his father gave Hashgacha to gelatin. So Rabbi Ralbag, perhaps thinking that maybe that's the reason that some people didn't accept it. It's hard to know. And he had the Coca-Cola contract years ago. After first it was Rabbi Geffen, and I think it was Rabbi Pardes, and then Simcha Elberg, I believe, even had it. But Rabbi Ralbag had the Coca-Cola contract. It's hard to know how you get out of the reputation. Like, well, I don't know. What would Rose Triangle K need to do for the local VODs to accept it? I don't know. Okay, so Larry says that Omaha stopped. It wasn't one of the major agencies. Yeah, you need to... So Barry Hartman says, Rabbi Azalongo gave Ashkacha non-glot meat from Rabashkin. What I was told by someone supposedly in the know is that Rabbi Azalongo didn't really do anything. This is just OU-approved shochtim, and mashkichim, etc. And when the meat came out and it wasn't up to OU glot standards, that is, there's a couple sirchot, small sirchot, they call them rears, that they would then give to Rabbi Zion Gold, who put the Ashgacha on it. But it was determined to be kosher from the OU. It's not like Rabbi Zion Gold was there, maybe visited once, but it was all, I was told to me that it was a complete OU operation, and since the OU did not want to mark it anymore as a non-glot, therefore Rabbi Zion Gold did. I can't say this, but that's what I was told. Yes, so Sosbach says Rabbi Yost had been in Montreux. Yes, Rabbi Yost in Yeshiva in Montreux. I wrote to him once and he never replied, but the person from Amsterdam said, I think he has a daughter there or something, that he's going to look into that and see if there's some letters. So thank you, David. I couldn't, it's hard for me to, if I'm holding you all here, I can't be looking up stuff. Lo aleichem and Eicha with, it's an Aleph. And the reason I couldn't find it when I quickly searched on my fast online thing is because I didn't spell with a Vav. That's why I couldn't find it. So you see, it's Lo aleichem with an Aleph. But today we say, we use it with an Ayin. Okay, everyone. Thank you very much again. We had about, at the height, I think we had almost 60 people on today. We still have 44 with me as we speak. So thanks again, everyone. And till next week, till we meet again. Unfortunately, Rabbi Kelman, something came up and he said he might not be here and he's not here. But I know they're finishing their Tanakh tomorrow. So I encourage that as well. Good night, everyone.